study of the map of Asia will reveal that vast, comparatively unexplored area, which extends to Chinese Xinjiang and Turkestan, across an incredible wilderness, desert, to finally end in the Nejd and Hejaz, what we call today Saudi Arabia. This distance to ancient man must have been an incredible mystery. We know that 7th and 9th centuries AD, Chinese scholars and monks crossed this vast expanse. Some of them were gone 12 years on the journey. And there was very little that this uncharted wilderness of comfort or security or even hope of survival. But by this long and dangerous Silk of China was brought to gladden the hearts of the pharaohs of Egypt and to make fine raiment for the emperors of Rome. It was interesting to realize that in this great region with rare oases, a kind of route was set up with posting stations. Every few hundred miles is a village or some place of rest. In most cases, the goods was unloaded on the backs of camels and given to another section of the caravan to carry on. Those who started in China were not likely to reach North Africa. But they did this entire process by relays. But along this same mysterious road, a certain exchange of ideas occurred. The various stations were eager of news. They lived alone, far from the unfolding processes of world civilization. They wanted tidings, the great civilizations that skirted their desolate path. But by degrees, the communication was certainly established between Peking, Constantinople, Alexandria, and possibly Rome. This communication line was very thin and was broken many times. But along this same road later, Nestorian Christians, seeking to escape the persecutions of their more orthodox brethren, fled into the wilderness and reached Peking in the second or third century of the Christian era. So while the going was hard, the road was dangerous, it was heavily traveled. But perhaps this thin thread of communication explains a great many mysteries relating to the parallels between certain cultural practices of Europe and Asia. He knew that in seeking for the origin or the beginning of certain rather common stories and traditions, we are defeated. We do not know where this great structure of legendary began. We do not know whether certain accounts were carried from Europe to Asia or from Asia to Europe. We do know, however, the same stories rose in both areas. But perhaps it is better and wiser to believe the Silk Road and the caravan route is the bridge that in those times bound the two hemispheres of the earth together. In any event, about the 5th century A.D., something was added to the pattern of world legendary. At this time, there began to emerge the dim shadow of the world hero. This world hero was something different from the traditions that had come down from earlier times. In Egypt, we know that the gods fought in the sky above the armies of the pharaohs. We know that in Greece, Athena guarded the city of which she was the patroness. There were many accounts of divine intercessions, spiritual beings coming to the aid of men. These accounts, however, are rather different in spirit from those that rose somewhat later. But about the 5th century A.D., we began to see the rise of the concept of man as hero. That the hero of the world was not a divine being, but in some way an immortal mortal, a demigod, bound strangely to the earth and to the human background of things, yet rising above this mortal heritage to some strange and awful destiny. Perhaps the most simple approach to this is to tell something of some of these world heroes and what they meant in their own time. Most of them were associated with a line of literary production that paralleled scripture, but was never quite scriptural. We have the Nordic saga, the wonderful legend of the Vultures, or Siegfried or Sigurd, the hero of the world. And in Western culture, I suppose the most complete expression of the folk hero was Siegfried. Here we have the man of destiny, a human being upon whom depended even the fate of the gods. For it was through Siegfried that Wotan hoped to restore the reign of the celestial beings over the earth. The world hero, as Sigurd or Siegfried, was a mortal immortal in several ways. He was strong, he was wise, he was possessed of wonderful insight. He could speak the language of birds and animals. He could slay the great dragon that guarded the treasure of the Nibelungs. And yet, he was strangely fallible. For in almost every instance, the hero died. The hero perished by betrayals. by assassination, by the corruption of his followers. Always there was the vulnerable point, the vulnerable spot. Always there was the heel of Achilles. In the case of Siegfried, he was drugged into forgetfulness by his own wife, leading to the final act of this great saga or drama, in which the whole hope of the gods and of men perished in the house of the Gibbetune. All these legends, therefore, are wonderful and sad. We remember the wonderful story of Charlemagne and his spouse Paladin, the song of Roland, the death of the hero, whose last message was carried for the trumpet call. We can also bring to mind from our own childish reading the great story of the Arthurian cycle, the good King Arthur and his knights of the Round Table. That final day, when mortally wounded, Arthur was carried away on a black barge to the mysterious Vale of Avalon. You remember the story of Parsifal, wonderful, guileless fool of the Grail, Lohengrin, the sworn knight, who came to rescue the maiden in distress. Always this wonderful cycle of stories. Stories that were sung by the troubadours, carried about for the minstrel from one end of Europe to another. In each area, the stories were reshaped a little to fit the local circumstances. The thread goes on. But for 500 years, these stories dominated the mental and cultural life of Europe. But they slowly faded away as though they had never been. All that is left of them are the fragmentary tales remembered in the works for children. All these stories have to do with this strange but profound concept that the fate of mankind rests upon the production out of humanity of the world hero. This world hero must stand as a kind of hostage for the rest of men. If this hero attains, all is saved. If this hero fails, all is lost. So we know that such a cycle probably originated among mystic societies of one kind or another. Societies like the Minnesang of High German, and later the Meistersingers of Nuremberg. These stories were not originally written down. There is no ancient and original manuscript of them. Very few early examples have ever been placed in writing at all. And it was long before some bard or minstrel decided commit them to parchment or to paper. They were remembered. They were part of the heritage of oral tradition. And as the changing moods of human beings refocused man's attention upon other projects, these old fables seemed to fade away. Where they came from, really, is probably one of the literary mysteries of the West. There were hundreds of them, and in various forms and kinds, they flowed through all the cultures of Europe. No source has actually been found. The only way we can trace them is by following the footsteps wandering minstrel who carried the stories from one land to another, vanished in his time, and another took his place. So we begin to realize that there's some kind of an archetypal pattern behind this story of the world hero. It is not difficult to gain some insight into it. It is part of man's psychology. Each human being, mysteriously within himself, regards his own uniqueness. He feels himself to be different. And from this difference has come not only a great deal of progress, but a vast amount of tyranny. Man, possessed by the sense of destiny in himself, has become both benefactor and despot. Pressed on by the relentless selfness that was greater than body, greater than life, greater than valor, really, and greater than the world. So we have always been plagued by these strange false heroes who grew strong and selfish and tore down the very good that perhaps they themselves had earlier built up. But man believes himself to be in some way a very powerful creature, we know. We do not really dare to contradict this vision. Locked within every human being is a greatness that he does not comprehend. Some way, each one of us, at least in the small world of our own affairs, must become the hero. We must save our own private worlds, or they will fall apart. But every individual has a responsibility to preserve, protect, and lead the small area where his influence is felt. On the other side of the world, this story of the hero takes on a number of rather esoteric implications. It's no longer pleasant folklore to be sung in the presence of assembled nobles at some festival of court. In the East, the hero of the world mingles his personality with the religion, the philosophy, the deepest metaphysics of the people. Along the caravan route through Tufan and Sun Wan, when the fires were built at night, the travelers were resting from the arduous journey of their caravan. Men gathered, a little afraid, under the strange dark night with its glittering stars. They were little people lost in a great world of sand and rock and mountain and desert. Only by some strange good fortune had they even found the oasis with its preserving water. But these men who live forever on the brink of disaster and on the edge of danger gathered and told their stories. Gave reports of various things. And along this stretch of road came into existence, so far as we can tell, the story of Ghazar Khan, the hero of the world. We have tried to some measure to understand how this story accumulated. But even experts in the field have been able to accomplish very little more than those who have tried to trace the legendary of the West. No complete record or account of the great saga of Ghazar of Lin is known to exist. It has been broken up, and fragments of it have become the treasures of countless storytellers. Estimates have been made. If all the known versions of this legend could be brought together, and enough storytellers, each who had a chapter or a section of his own, could be caused to put these together into one fabric, then these storytellers told their tales, each beginning where the previous one left off to make the saga complete. It is estimated that the narration of the story at the rate of speaking 24 hours a day would require better than 3 years. It is an enormous story. So the Asiatic, of course, has never had the attitude for condensation and abridgment with which we are favored by the Reader's Digest. In these lands, men did not desire to briefen their stories. The longer, the better. They loved to go into the most intimate details of every account, mingling prose with poetry, reliving, reenacting the minutest details of these legendary epics. And as a result, you may sit for several evenings while the storytellers unfold their beautiful tales. But even so, you will get only a tiny fragment of the greater work. Although printing was known in this area at a comparatively early date, as far as we can tell, no printed version of the Gyatso Khan was ever prepared in Tibet. There was an edition in China in the early 18th century under the patronage of the great Emperor Qianlong. All these copies, however, where they exist, are extremely rare. A few manuscripts are known. These also are almost as ephemeral as the circumstances which they set forth. There are two distinct stories or versions of the Gyatso legend. One, Mongolian, and the other, Tibetan. As might be expected, these vary in numerous details, but not enough to disrupt the essential developments of the theme. Each improvises from the central concept, adding wonderful embellishments, embellishments that are measured by the hours that it requires to tell them. But the central heroic theme stands essentially the same in both traditions. It is now believed, in all probability, that the oldest form of the Gyatso legend is Tibetan, and that the Mongolian version was derived from that. On the other hand, the very name Gyatso Khan suggests the Mongols. We have not as yet any clear understanding of the meaning of the name, and that is rather important, but is also quite an interesting aspect of the situation. Of course, the word Khan is comparatively easy. It is equivalent to the Western word prince or king. And it became the imperial title of Genghis Khan and his descendants. We may perhaps liken it to a form of emperor. It represented a ruler over rulers. And the highest form of it, of course, was the name that was given, or the title that was given to Genghis and Kublai Khan. They were called the Khakans, or the kings of kings, the rulers over the rulers of the earth. Gyatso presents more of a little mystery. We have no genuine root for it in the ancient languages of that area. And it seems to many scholars, and perhaps they are not too far astray, that it was derived from a Western word, perhaps the word Caesar, Geza Caesar, or the form which we find in the Teutonic culture, Kaiser or Kaiser. This again might only mean another title of nobility, of rulership. So a Ghazar Khan might simply again mean the king of the kings. A preferred term, perhaps, to signify the noblest of all mortals, the hero prince of the world. It is probable, according to some thinking, that like many legends, the Ghazar Khan had some historical background. Perhaps there was a person in those old days when Northern Asia was comparatively unknown beyond its own boundaries, where tribes had no solid records, where gradually tradition emerges largely as a result of the rise of Buddhism in Tibet, Nepal, and Mongolia. Until the Buddhists brought writing and a written language and began the classification of knowledge, these older tribes lived almost entirely dependent upon oral tradition for the preservation of their records. They were much like the American Indians, who also developed their hero myths, like the hero of the legend of Great Rabbit, the basis of Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha. Be this as it may, the historical Ghazar Khan, if he existed, soon dissolved in myth. We have no way of estimating his time, although some feel that he probably could have existed or could have lived sometime in between the 7th and 9th century of the Christian era. As these dates emerge, we sort of raise an eyebrow a little bit, for it was at precisely that time that the great cycle of myths was developing in Europe. Actually, we would have the Ghazar Khan almost a contemporary of King Arthur, or of Charlemagne, or of the mysterious heroes of the Grail. So whatever happened seems to have happened at the same time in two very distant parts of the world. The Khan word also comes back to us from our own Western Hemisphere, the hero of the Aztec Empire, the hero of the Maya people, remembered through this ancient region as Kukulkan, the feathered serpent. And here in the West, the word Khan seems to signify serpent. But it is also true that whereas it signified serpent, the serpent in its own turn signified royalty, or signified the great wisdom, the priesthood, the supreme rulers of the state, the custodians of the secret lore and legendary of the people. The Ghazar Khan includes a number of elements which are extremely reminiscent of the Western folklore with which we are better acquainted. Like all the other heroes of the world, Ghazar of Lynn was immaculately conceived. He was born, it is said, as the result of his mother drinking the pure water of a mountain spring from a bowl of yellow jade on which were inscribed the 8 emblems of Buddhist immortality. The coming of Ghazar of Lynn was heralded, was announced. There was a strange annunciation that accompanied his advent. For even then, it was assumed that he was looked forward to not only by men, but by the gods themselves. In the wonderful world above, in the Tushita heaven, where the Bodhisattva Maitreya rules supreme, it was affirmed or believed that the great powers and the great ones waited breathlessly for the embodiment of the Geza Khan. Not that he was distinctly and strictly a religious avatar, for this is not the case. Rather, he seemed to be what we might call in Europe the defender of the faith. He was the hero warrior. He was the one who was to protect the truth down through the long ages of darkness. He was the servant of right, the vassal of the law. And just as the knights in Europe dedicated their swords before the altars of their faiths, binding themselves into a semi-religious order of chivalry, and just as this chivalry produced these perfected virgin knights like Sir Galahad, so it was believed that these wonderful, dedicated persons were not soldiers in the ordinary sense of the word. They were really defenders of God, some way protecting and guarding mankind through the long, dark centuries when virtue failed among men. It was necessary for some strange, mysterious order of life to protect those who could not protect themselves. Something of this lurks in the story of Geza of Ling. Prior to the time or advent of Geza Khan, a very strange and wonderful man had gone from the University of Nalanda in central India up to the mysterious regions of the north. It is said that he was sent for because the wives of the king of Tibet were Buddhists and wanted the consolation of their faith in the great wilderness where they dwelt. And over this pilgrimage to bring truth beyond the great mountains, there was placed a general of the law, a great teacher, who is known today as the Blessed Guru, or the Wizard Guru, Padmasambhava, the founder, so to say, of Tibetan Lamaism, driving before him oxen loaded with books, carrying the sacred utensils of the faith, images for the altars, rosaries for the pious, carrying with him also the rudiments of knowledge. For it was said then and has been said since that when the Buddhists loaded up books on the backs of oxen to take them to a distant land, they placed the books of faith on one side of the ox, and the books of medicine, law, jurisprudence, science, art, and industry on the other side of the ox. They never went only with religious books. They took all knowledge that they could with them. For they realized, even back in the days of the glory of Nalanda, that you cannot bring religion to a people unless you can civilize them, unless you can prepare within them a new appreciation of value. You can never bind them to an abstract faith. Well, the Wizard Guru took with him, among other priceless belongings, the thunderbolt scepter of the god Indra. He started out on a journey which no man had made before him, a journey across the top of the world, a journey into the mountains where, according to the earlier Hindu traditions, the gods dwelt, into those snowy wastes in the midst of which great Shiva sat, in sackcloth and ashes, the great mendicant. using his own life and his own soul as a hostage for the salvation of men. And here also in these remote places were demons, monsters, strange animals and still stranger men, animals that ate the flesh of each other and men that ate the flesh of men. And into this unconquered, unknown world of snow and height, of long winters and short summers, the blessed Guru made his way, finally crossing this incredible expanse of wilderness, surviving infinite hardships, and turning the thunderbolt dagger in one direction and another to destroy the demons that guarded the passes. Padmasambhava came finally to the court of the King of Tibet. Here he was kindly received. The mere fact that he had survived was itself the greatest miracle that he had performed. And Padmasambhava not only converted the king, but established the first temple or monastery to his faith. He had a royal patronage, were carefully preserved the books that he had brought, and young men turned to study them under his help and guidance. And he remained for some time there until he was able to ordain monks and form a Sangha, or a Brotherhood of the Enlightened. In a few years that he was there, his wondrous thunderbolt performed one miracle after another. Human sacrifice ceased. Cannibalism ceased. The strange primitive beast deities of the wandering Tibetan nomads, although they were invisible like spirits of the air, were converted to the true faith by the matchless preachings of the wizard guru. In every feat of magic, he surpassed the magician. In every wonder and miracle, he was able to transcend the achievements of the shaman and all the other primitive witch doctors of that world. And in the course of things, he made the doctrine of the Blessed Law the central wheel upon which the turning culture of North Asia was to move from that time on. Finally, when he had completed all the works that he was supposed to do, he rose into the air, and with a chariot of followers, of singing musicians, of angels, of angelic beings, of saints and sages, not normally visible to men, he floated across the sky on his journey to another land which had called him, the island of Ceylon. We do not know much about the legend of the Blessed Guru after his departure from the northern land. But we know that in the course of time, this legend came to be involved in the myth of the Geza Khan. One involvement was, the first, that the Blessed Guru, Padmasambhava, is reported to have announced the coming of the King of the World. In other words, he was the one who made the prophecy, who established the pattern. He was a kind of Merlin to this northern King Arthur. And as Merlin went to sleep in a mysterious sphere of glass, and there remained resting through the centuries, so Padmasambhava departed into Ceylon, where he is said still to dwell in the invisible regions of the atmosphere, performing the miracles that preserve his faith. Also, when the Geza Khan was miraculously born, it was believed that a strange telepathy was set up. That Padmasambhava in far-off Ceylon was able to communicate by mind alone, to guard and to guide and to impress his thoughts and his will upon Geza of Ling. Perhaps this was because when the child Geza was born, he had a third eye in the middle of his forehead. Now, as third eyes are not especially fashionable, this circumstance caused considerable consternation. And in order that her boy might not suffer from such embarrassment, the mother is said to have closed the eye with her finger and prayed that it might not deform her otherwise handsome son. And the eye remained closed, but a little fold of skin remained. And there was a sensitivity in this eye which seems to tie to the concept of the urner or coil on the forehead of Buddha, and for that matter, the coiled serpent on the foreheads of the pharaohs of Egypt. So Geza of Ling grew up like young Siegfried, a wonder of the world. He grew up in a strange region of nature, a wild, desolate nature. And even from the beginning, his powers and his abilities were remarkable and extraordinary in every way. And gradually, he became the Bishamonten, or the guardian king of the Buddhist community in Tibet. He was there patron while he lived, and his patron saint, and their patron saint when he was gone. The exploits of his life were almost too numerous to mention. But certain points about him are perhaps worthy of consideration. First of all, in the North Country, both in the Mongolian and Tibetan versions of the story, two explanations are offered for Geza Khan. The first, that he was a thought being, that he was fashioned by the mind of the law, that he was an apparition who appeared because of the power of universal mind focusing upon him. He was a shadow, a shade, a kind of projected ghost or image. That actually he was a thought, a tremendous thought made visible by the intensity of the great minds that produced him. And here is a thought also. Perhaps the Geza Khan was a thought arising in the minds of men. Perhaps his whole image is a thought form. Perhaps actually he was the long projection of convictions, the shadow of invisibles cast upon the substance of the earth. Perhaps he was really man's own dream, heroic, but always fallible. Always within this dream, some limitation, some restriction, some ineptitude. That in the end must turn it into a nightmare. The second explanation for the Geza Khan is that he was the embodiment of a bodhisattva. That he was actually a kind of fortuitous incarnation. That the great meditating powers resting in judgment over the world could project themselves, taking on forms at will, inhabiting these forms until the purposes were attained, and then departing from them. Some of these legends tell us very frankly that Geza Khan was a kind of special child, that in his infancy and youth, he was himself. that he had embodied from the mysterious regions of the Tushita world, but that in the price and course of his embodiment, he had assumed the obligation that at a certain time and under certain conditions, he would turn over his body, renouncing it for himself and placing it at the disposal of one of the bodhisattvas. This being would then enter into it and perform its ministry or achieve its purposes by dwelling in the body of another. And then when the time was finished, the bodhisattva would restore the body to the entity which had originally fashioned it. Now this seems a kind of a strange belief, and yet what else do we have in the 3 years of the ministry of Jesus? We are told that a spirit descended upon him in the form of a dove at the baptism by John, and that this spirit departed from him at the time of the crucifixion. So are we telling any essentially different story? It might be shocking to think of it that way, but at the same time, if we have the courage to think it through, there are certainly parallels. How did these parallels come into existence? Did some strange account of Jesus reach this region through the Nestorian migrations? What was the way in which the various elements of the Geza Khan were brought together? All we can say is that he was regarded either as a projection of mind or as the embodiment of a bodhisattva, one of the great beings in meditation sent his own mind and consciousness into the form of this lad and used this form to accomplish the preservation of the people. The next point that I think we have to bear in mind is that the background of Geza Khan is also very closely tied with two other important elements. One of these elements is the mystery of Chang Shambhala, the city of the gods. In the Tibetan legendary, particularly as we meet it along the old caravan routes, where the legendary is vivid, if not always entirely authentic, there is the belief that Geza of Ling was one of the mysterious princes guarding the ramparts of Shambhala. Now, what is Shambhala? It is the city of the gods. Shambhala is the mysterious abode in the north. And in those desert days when the northern lights played in the cold hours of winter, it was believed that these radiances in the sky were flickering lights from the ramparts of Shambhala. Shambhala was the seat of the invisible government of the world. It was to Shambhala that the great Arhats had gone. It was Shambhala that was the abode of the immortals. It was from here that the regent of Shambhala guarded and guided the destiny of the whole world. His was the invisible government which linked all nations, empires, states, and peoples together in a strange commonwealth of yoga. The second element that is involved in this interesting story is the school of the Kala Chakra. And this is the mysterious wheel of destiny, the wheel of fire, the wheel of secret power. Kalachakra was a secret school which claimed to possess the mysteries of the five yogas. The Kalachakra was the central universal university, the abode of the great wisdom. The Kalachakra school spread broadly through Asia, with mysterious rites and ceremonies which we now associate with Tantra, and which survive in Japan in the Shingonshu and the Tendaishu, the two great Kalachakra schools which still flourish in Japan. This mysterious school was not a school of sorcerers or magicians or wizards, but it was the school of the skywalking men. It seems to have been very closely identified with the achievements of the arhats of Buddhism. For these arhats really represented rishis or adepts scattered over the entire surface of the earth. And upon them rested the responsibility of the preservation of man and the continuance of the doctrine until the coming or the advent of the Buddha Maitreya. It's interesting in the old writings bearing upon this to realize that there is a kind of strange fatality almost, like tragedy of the Nibelungen in this story of the arhats or the ancient adept. For the old writers tell us that these adepts, Chinese Lohan, remained and guarded and guided through the long, dark, deepening night of the Kali Yuga. But as they labored desperately to keep alight the mysterious flame of the doctrine, this flame ever flickered lower. Little by little, men turned from the law. We find in the old books the prophecies of times to come. While the Lohan or the Arhats watched, unable to change the course of destiny, they saw the great cycles of karma closing in upon human destiny. The old writings, they must sit in quiet meditation while worlds fall apart. The arhats can only guide and save the truth seeker. They can only help those who are strangely and wonderfully dedicated. But it is written in one of the great books of the arhats that wherever in the world men gather together for the celebration of the good law, wherever men unite to worship truth, to serve each other unselfishly, whenever a congress or a convention of the worthy and the noble takes place, wherever the holy ones gather to honor their faith, the arhats, in some human form, not immediately recognizable, will be there. For they have the power to fly over the mountains, to cross oceans, to see into infinite distances. They know all the good that is going on in the world. But also there is a strange sadness, for they must know also the evil that occurs. And they were told at the time, it is said, that Buddha ordained them that they should go forth to preserve the doctrine until the day when the next teacher should arise. The concept here seems to have been borrowed very strongly from the Hindic point of view. For in the Bhagavad Gita, we find Krishna saying, when virtue fails upon the earth, then I come forth. The Arhats knew that virtue was to fail upon the earth. One by one, all the lights of truth would go out. The flames would flicker low. Darkness would descend upon mankind. Ignorance would prevail. Viciousness would take over. The noble ideals would be perverted by selfishness and self-interest. Until in the end, those who were true to the law could be counted on the fingers of the hands. When this occurred, also the life of men would be shortened. A man would be very proud and happy if he lived 10 years. Everything would grow strangely dark. And then in that last moment, the Arhats in prayer would beseech the coming of the teacher. And then the Maitreya would come forth. He would descend from the Tushita heaven to bring with him the reformation of the world. Now into the Deja Khan has been built much of this story. But the story of the Geza Khan is indeed the story of the world losing the battle for truth. Heroically struggling on, fighting to preserve value, only to see value slowly, relentlessly disappear. But no matter how much wisdom and truth and beauty was expended, still the light would go out. And that the only answer lay in the waiting for the Maitreya. For in that desperate moment when virtue failed, the Lord of the world would come. And when the Lord of the world came, the Arhats would go to sleep in Nirvana. Their labor was done. Until then, like mysterious unknown wanderers, unrecognized, they would ever wander about the earth, trying to bring truth, trying to bring light. They would be embodied in countless forms, but always they were dedicated, lives ago, to the labor they would perform. In the story of the Geza Khan, we see these factors opposed very dramatically. For against the hero of the world was raised the Mongolian equivalent of Hegan. Against him rose also the traitor knight of the Round Table, the traitor knight of the circle of Charlemagne, the betrayer. And this betrayer is present, of course, in the Geza Khan story, working constantly to undermine the labors of the hero, resolved to destroy the great king in order that he might rule instead. Now, the great king is actually, of course, the law itself. Geza Khan, therefore, becomes in one of his manifestations the eternal workings of the law of karma. He is the world king and the great king. He is the ruler of all that lives. He is the ruler that is betrayed. He is the ruler against which the adversary rises up, crying to the people, he is a false god. We realize the same thing in our Christian tradition, the betrayal of Christ. For on this occasion, Christ was accused of claiming to be the true king of the Jews.